Hello, Lee Hendrickson here with Marianne Holmquist, and together we're interviewing Nancy Pfeiffer, a local mountaineer who's just publishing a book in May. So welcome, Marianne and Nancy.
Thanks. It's great to be here. And can I say I'm the president of Nancy's fan club?
Thanks. It's great to be here. And good. I didn't even know I had a fan club.
Well, all due to Marianne. Thank you. Well, I want to start out with Nancy. It's just finding out who you are. So tell us a little bit about yourself, if you would.
I'm a misplaced person from suburban America. I transplanted up here from outside of Denver, and I found a home in Palmer, Alaska.
Yeah, good. And what do you do for a living?
All kinds of different guiding. Guiding, I take people into the wilderness for a living. Did a lot of mountaineering guiding. And I also work in the winter as an avalanche forecaster.
Okay. And so you have written a book called Riding into the Heart of Patagonia. And so where is Patagonia?
So Patagonia is a region that encompasses two countries. It's the southern part of Chile as well as the southern part of Argentina. So it's not a country or a state. It's a region. And all of my travels were in the Chilean Patagonian side.
Great. And what's special about it? Or one thing that's special about it? I mean, I know for you there's a multitude probably.
I feel in a lot of ways like the region of Patagonia that I was traveling in is like the Matanuska Valley 50 or 100 years ago. Mm. People still get around on horseback. They visit each other's houses. They go, they take their kids to school on horseback. And it's a rich rural flavor that I feel like somehow I managed to miss in my life. And so I found like I found another home there.
Okay.
Jumping backwards in time.
Okay. And you have a reading from your book that talks about your first real connection to that place.
Yeah. I went down there initially as a Knowles instructor. Knowles is the National Outdoor Leadership School right here on Farm Loop Road. And this is Patagonia, 1993. A man approached on a horse. His mount, a rusty red beauty, sported the short trimmed mane and neatly squared off tail of a well-kept mount. Colorful, hand-woven saddlebags tied behind a sheepskin-covered saddle held groceries from town. The man wore goatskin chaps, a woolen poncho, and the jaunty black beret typical of the region. Crinkles around his eyes spoke of years of squinting into the sun. This man and his horse belonged to this place in a way I could only dream of. He paused on the banks of the rain-swollen river to stare at us, a group of college students, up to our knees in mud and dwarfed in huge backpacks. Wet and hungry, we had been stacked up on the wrong side of the river for days. Our next food supply, a few kilometers away on the other side of the torrent. He looked perplexed. We had tents. We had expensive rain jackets. We obviously had money, but we had no horses. ¿Por qué no tienes caballos? He asked as he rode into the river. The strong current piled up around his horse's belly. The man gently lifted his feet from the stirrups and placed them on the horse's rump so as not to wet his boots, as his horse strode confidently through the rushing water. ¿Por qué somos estúpidos? Was the answer that popped into my mind. That moment I knew. I wanted to travel this country like the people who lived here. I longed to know this place as only one on horseback can. Having ridden a horse only a few times in my life, I knew practically nothing about them. This was irrelevant. There was a 13-year-old girl inside of me who desperately wanted a horse.
That was great. That was a great image. And then you went and did it. You went, you planned a trip. You weren't like a horseback person. You weren't a person who knew horses. So you came home, took horseback lessons, had to go down to Patagonia, buy a horse, and just take off. So what was that first day like, the first day you were leaving on your own to just travel across Patagonia by yourself?
Well, first off, it was a long time trying to get a horse, to get rigged up, to take off. And then, you know, when I finally did, I had way too much excess baggage and worries and uncertainties, as well as way too much excess baggage in extra hardback books and spare sunglasses and things I didn't need. So on my first day out, about halfway into the day, I'm walking down the road, leading my horse, telling myself my horse is tired, but really my own butt is sore. And I've accumulated all of the things that kept falling out of my saddlebags onto my back and put them in my backpack. And an old truck with an older Patagonian couple comes by and takes a look at me. And I just see myself as they see me, not as a woman on an expedition bound for the southern end of a continent, but this disorganized gringa leading a perfectly good horse down the road. So I had a long ways to go to realize my dream of riding across the country like the people that live there. Uh-huh. And that was my dream.
Right. But you did. You went back multiple times, many, many trips. So in the book, it was just a beautifully written book, Nancy. And I loved that your chapters were titled not only in English but in Spanish. And you incorporated a lot of Spanish in the book that just brought us right into the culture. So talk a little bit about the hospitality of the people as you traveled across on horseback.
It was amazing. I felt so warmly accepted there. If you can imagine opening your front door and hollering out at someone across the street to come on in for tea, in this country, they'd probably think you were a nut. Absolutely common. People would just open their doors and holler to stop for tea. And yeah, it was expected if you arrived in the later part of the day, it was expected that you were staying the night. And a lot of times, if people didn't have a lot of money, they didn't have a lot of grass at certain times of the year, and you know, asking to graze a couple, three horses was a big deal. And no one, you know, it was absolutely expected that you were eating dinner, staying the night, grazing your animals there. And people would tell me, you know, when you come to my house, I provide for you. When I come to your house, mm-hmm. you provide for me. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get my gringo brain to wrap around the fact that this old guy was never coming to my house. Mm-hmm. But of course, it didn't matter who you provided for. It was just this big circle.
So do you find yourself providing, I'm just curious, how do you provide for people to come to your house? Or has that happened to you? You've been able to return the energy?
I really try to, yeah. At one point, I camped right behind in the windbreak of some people's house with three horses who were not home. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, how would I react if I came home and found two people and three horses camping behind my house? Mm-hmm. And I would hope with grace and hospitality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I certainly try. It's not as easy in this country because it's not normal to just invite people in.
Right.
And it's in your book, as you're traveling across the country of Patagonia, your descriptions are incredible. But you also encounter a lot of environmental issues and roads that are going in and rivers to be dammed. And can you talk specifically about the sheep ranch that later became a national park with the Tompkins people and how you saw it before it was a national park? Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have a reading, or I can... So I have a section from the book that talks about when I first come into the Estancia Chacabuco, which is the valley that became protected. As the country broke open, so did my mood. I imagined myself racing through this open, hilly country at a full gallop, blonde hair whipping behind me, saddlebags flying. Instead, I settled for a good, fast walk and an occasional trot. The horses seemed to feel the exhilaration of space as well. It was the fastest we had traveled in days. All trails eventually funneled together and deposited me in the backyard of the headquarters of Estancia Valle Chacabuco, the largest sheep ranch in this part of Patagonia. Tidy white houses and trim with green trim and well-maintained lawns lined a new gravel road. The place felt orderly, rigid, and controlled, a bit too much like the British countryside for Patagonia. In contrast to the friendly family farms I usually passed through, I felt awkward here. There was no one around to either stop me or welcome me. Marching my ungainly parade through the neatly kept grounds felt like an intrusion. I had no other option. My only exit was in front of me. Between 1930 and 1970, the eastern half of Patagonia had gone from being the home of guanacos, a wild cousin of the llama, to pasture for 16 million sheep. Now 100 dusty sheep waited in a corral outside a long shearing barn. Between overgrazing and the relentless Patagonian winds, the sheep waiting to be shorn were so covered in the topsoil of the region, they appeared brown. I could hear men shouting over an electric buzzing sound inside the barn, At least a dozen men were working. Agredaderos grabbing sheep and tied their feet together. Esquiladores did the shearing. Playeros cleaned the wool from the floor, and vellonos packed the wool tightly into huge bags. Outside, the grounds were deserted. It wasn't apparent by the spotless buildings or the tidy green lawns, but times were changing. Established in the early 1900s, this ranch had, in its heyday, grazed over 85,000 sheep on 500 acres. But falling wool prices and the desertification brought on by overgrazing were taking a toll. In the mid-90s, wool prices hit a bottom record low of 30 cents a pound. On the day I passed through, the Estancia Chacabuco grazed only 25,000 sheep. Unbeknownst to me, an even bigger change was looming just below the horizon. Two unique circumstances were converging. The surge of money behind a boom in the manufacturing of outdoor clothing and equipment in the United States, and a wave of philanthropy, the desire to give back to the places that inspire us. Unable to see into the future, I never imagined the trim lawns and shearing barns of Estancia Chacabuco as headquarters for the region's largest national park. This land had been on the Chilean Park Service's national priority list for more than 30 years, but it would take outside money to make it happen. Within the next 4 years, this estancia would be purchased by Conservation Patagonica, a private land trust set up for the conservation of biodiversity. Someday, behind the willow trees along the bank, will stand a modern visitor center powered by the sun. Over the next decade, Conservation Patagonica President Christine Tompkins, formerly of the Patagonia Clothing Company, along with her husband Douglas Tompkins, founder of North Face and Esprit, and his partner organization, Conservation Land Trust, would work to protect over 3 million acres of prime habitat in Chile and Argentina. Passing through the estancia unnoticed, I turned east, down what would turn out to be a long, fence-lined dirt road. Over the next decade, the new landowners would remove over 400 miles of fence line that now separated me, if only by a wire, from that open space I so craved.
I loved that sentence.
Wow.
Less than a month ago, Christine Tompkins and the Conservation Land Trust and the entire country of Chile collectively put aside over 10 million acres for conservation. So they donated this piece of land, another huge piece of land in Patagonia, and the country matched that with 9 million more acres to put into conservation, an area the size of Switzerland.
Right. Wow. So when was the original national park formed?
The Patagonia National Park that we're talking about? Well, there's two reserves north and south of there that already existed when I rode through it. It was still an estancia. And so by buying this ranch in between these two already preserved parks, they could basically get a national park the size of Yosemite. And that national park just got donated to Chile less than a month ago.
Wow. Okay. So this is all very new.
Yeah. And they have an infrastructure there to provide housing for people. And
Because of the sheep ranch.
No, they have put in a very modern, fancy infrastructure. And their idea behind that was by producing that when they donated the land, the park would have a way to sustain itself financially.
Okay. That reminds me of a question I have for you. It's like, about how many trips have you taken to Patagonia, and how long does it take to get there from here, from Palmer?
I have actually lost track of how many trips exactly.
More than 20.
No, I haven't. It's been 20 years that I probably have not gone back every year for sure.
So somewhere a dozen, more or less, 18, 15?
Yeah, of them, I think the shortest ones are 6 weeks or 2 months, and I've been there as long as 9 months at a time.
Okay. Wow.
And
how long does it take to get there from Anchorage?
About 15 to 18 hours.
Wow, a long time.
Yep, a long ways.
And you flip seasons when you go.
Yep.
So talk a little bit about what it's like to have your heart in two different places in Alaska and Patagonia.
Sometimes it's quite hard. I considered living in Patagonia quite a bit. And I found that it's actually harder than I thought it was to live outside your culture. I adore the Patagonian culture, and yet just to know that I would always be an outsider. Mm-hmm. I finally made the ultimate decision that I was going to stay here.
Okay. I'm wondering if you might have, this is a funny question on how to ask it without sounding peculiar, but if you didn't have blonde hair, might it have been easier? I mean, you so look like you don't fit in that even if you've been there 80 years, they would still say there's that gringa.
Yeah, I can tell you the story of my friend Lily,
oh, right.
who was born Chilean, had to leave during the Pinochet era, grew up in Germany, started third grade without a word of German, lived most of her life in Germany, got married, had kids, moved back to Chile, and her and her husband bought a farm because they could afford to buy a farm in Chile, where in Europe, if your parents weren't farmers, you'll never be a farmer. And she was really struggling with the small town that she lived in and being always that German lady. She was dark-skinned, beautiful, long, dark hair, spoke perfect Spanish. She was born pura chilena. And to the townspeople, she would always be that German lady. I mean, people remember for generations where you came from. Mm-hmm. People who'd lived in Patagonia who were from a different part of Patagonia 25 years ago still talked about being, the Chilote, the guy from Chiloé. Mm-hmm. It was hopeless.
Right. But it sounds sort of like our native cultures where it's like here in Alaska, where it's like where you're from and who your family is and people.
Exactly. Like the people that I ended up riding in this protest ride with were the sons and daughters and granddaughters of the people who settled the land. Mm-hmm. Like this valley is full of Aratias and this other valley is full of Sotos. Mm-hmm. And that's,
so talk about that ride. That was at the end of the book. And it was just such a beautiful event.
So, but we should maybe set a context of what caused the ride, too.
Okay, so
sounds like you have another.
There's
reading.
A lot of change going on in Patagonia, like everywhere in the world. But one of the things the world is hungry for is cheap electricity, and Patagonia has free-flowing rivers and some of the largest freshwater reserves on the planet. And during the Pinochet era, these were lost. The water rights were lost to private companies. So the repercussions of that was that during the time I was riding down there, there was a huge push to dam the Bocker and Pasco rivers and run a power line the length of Patagonia all the way up to Santiago.
For aluminum plants.
Well, right? There was also another push to dam another river and put in aluminum plants. So, you know, this is the tip of the iceberg. If these rivers were dammed and the infrastructure were put in for this power line, Patagonia would be open for industry. All kinds of aluminum smelters would want to flock there. So the people who live there were adamantly against this. But how do people who live in small towns and on rural farms gain a voice? They hold a cabalgata, a 330-kilometer horseback ride in protest of the dams. And I had the incredible privilege to ride next to the sons and daughters of the people who settled this land in this horseback ride. And we started as 30 people in Cochrane, and we arrived in the capital as 125 people on horseback. And it was a life-changing event, and in a lot of ways I feel like I didn't start this process as a writer, but life handed me a story. Mm-hmm. And so it took me 10 years to learn to ride it.
Right. So that ride was 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Right.
And then tell us what happened. What?
So today the rivers of Patagonia are running free.
Yay.
I was just down to visit this last December, January. And during the time that I was there, Endesa returned the water rights to these two rivers to Chile.
Wow.
And, there's lots of young kayakers in Cochrane from the town of Cochrane with Patagonia Sin Represas stickers on their helmets running the whitewater in town. And they've got a budding tourism industry. And, I think it's actually a grassroots environmental protest that worked.
Wow.
And I loved some of the description of it where people coming together and riding and the intention to be nonviolent and to be respectful and having to get getting permission to ride into town It was, and having people join from all over.
And waiting. You spent a lot of time waiting outside the government building for recognition, for somebody to come out. And you spent a lot of time just waiting.
Yeah. I think it was 7 or 9 hours.
That was very powerful. It was a powerful chapter in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading it this morning and crying, so.
So, Nancy, did you keep a journal on your trip? Because your descriptions are so vivid and your memory so clear.
I did. During most of the trip, I had no idea I was writing a book. But I kept a journal, and looking back on it, I did not keep the kind of journal that I would have kept if I knew I was writing a book. And I probably started out all wrong in writing the book as well. Like I said, I was a novice writer, and I pretty much started the book with a type journal. And I pulled a lot of things from my journal, and it helped cement things in my memory. And one of the really great things about writing this book is I've been able to live several hours a day in my head in Patagonia for years now. Mm.
Okay. So how long have you been writing the book for?
10 years.
10 years, wow. So Writing Into the Heart of Patagonia by Nancy Pfeiffer is going to be released in May, but you have a book release party coming up.
April 28th.
April 28th, yeah. At Knowles here in Palmer.
Yep.
Great. And you can find more about it at nancypfeiffer.com.
Yep, or writingintotheheartofpatagonia.com, yep. Either one.
And you can purchase the book at Fireside?
You will be able to purchase it at Fireside Books really soon, mm-hmm. Yeah. As well as, you know, all the other places.
Right. So, so you had to figure out how to get the book written, and you stumbled upon a writer to help you, from what I understand.
Yeah. So. Yeah, at a New Year's bonfire, I reconnected with Deborah McKinney, author of Beyond the Bear, and we talked about writing for hours, and she asked to see my book. And she was the first, like, real writer who read my book. And she ended up helping me every step of the way.
Okay. Wonderful, wonderful. And then finding a publisher. I noticed it's a publisher that publishes women's books, books by women authors that you finally publish with.
Yeah, and initially I was timid about submitting to them because I'd had a lot of feedback that, you know, it needed more, I don't know, more drama or more, you know, personal story in it. And I felt like in so many ways, this is Patagonia's story as much as it is my story. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to keep it that way. And I was hesitant. And Bedazzled Inc., they were like, no, there's no reason we love it the way it is.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. There was a quote in the I'm paraphrasing from something in the book that you wrote about Lily that sort of describes Patagonia, but also maybe the writing of the book. It's that you first decided to follow your heart and then first deciding to do something and then learning how to do it. And it sounds like learning to be a horsewoman, learning to speak Spanish. You went to Patagonia and learned to speak Spanish and be a horsewoman and then writing a book.
Yeah. No, that's fairly normal behavior for me. I tend to throw myself headlong into things and then figure it out as I go.
Okay.
And it's pretty obvious from buying a horse and taking off across Patagonia to, okay, writing a book and then now I'm trying to figure out the whole publishing world. And it's definitely kind of one day at a time. Mm-hmm.
So for those people that are horse people, there's a lot of good horse reflections and descriptions in this book. For people that love horses and dream about walking across wilderness on horses, you'll love this book. But I would like you to talk a little bit about what it was like to travel alone as a woman, and both of those things, as a woman and just alone. Because some of your trips, you had a companion along. But many trips, you were just all by yourself.
Yeah, and I think that relates back to me kind of taking off on crazy adventures. And Initially, it was hard for me to find someone who would buy into that with me. And then after I'd survived a few of them, it was a little bit easier, I think. And it's, Patagonia is actually an incredibly safe place to travel, even as a woman alone. I'm looking for a little excerpt I'd like to read to you here. Okay, so I had completed one leg of the journey, and I was just doing a day ride from kind of where I was camping, getting ready for another leg of the journey. And I'd seen a couple of guys with a herd of goats in the morning, and I went out on my day ride, and I came back. And on the way back, I heard the familiar call, Mate, amiga, coming from the forest. The men I had seen earlier were resting in the shade with their goats. I joined them, first for mate, then for a big chunk of roasted goat, and later a long nap. How many places in the world was it the accepted custom for a woman traveling alone to stop, eat, drink, and fall happily asleep beside the trail alongside two men and 100 goats?
Two men she didn't know.
The people of southern Patagonia had told me many times, don't worry, there are no bad people here. They could say that with confidence because everyone knew everyone in the valley. That was until the road arrived. Deep inside, I knew I was living in a special time and place. I hoped somehow it would survive the coming years. But change was already brewing, unbeknownst to me and the people of O'Higgins.
Oh, so that brings me to another question. So could you go back today and recreate this ride?
It's still available. It's getting more limited by a lot of things. One is people's changing views on private property. You know, it was always accepted that anyone would pass. And then gringos buying property and people from Santiago coming in and bringing their thoughts about private property with them. All it takes is one locked gate and you can no longer access that whole valley. Roads have come in and gone right over the horse trail. So, you know, there's more road travel and less trail travel. But there's still, you know, there's still horse trails. There's still people living along those trails that don't have road access. There's definitely long rides you can do. But to link up huge sections like I did is getting harder and harder.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time here. So just if there's anything we didn't cover in the interview, Nancy, I'd love to make sure you get it in there.
I'd just like to invite people, I guess, to the book launch party that's April 28th at Knowles. There's going to be a signing May 7th at Fireside Books, and then over to a dinner at Turkey Red. There'll be some events in Anchorage and Girdwood as well. But yeah, just invite people to come see some amazing slides of pictures from my husband, Frederick Narcel, who's a photographer.
Oh, they were incredible in the book.
So his photos will be part of the show.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the book is a wonderful read, so I encourage you to pick up the book at Fireside Books.
Or Riding Into the Heart of Patagonia.
By Nancy Pfeiffer, Pfeiffer. So thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Nancy, another famous author from Palmer.